Sunday, partly sunny, warmer still, a high of 53. Right now, we have a temperature reading of 18 degrees. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The morning show with Greg Berg is coming up. Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News, and classical music on your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I am really excited about this upcoming hour of the morning show. We have two very special guests in our studios. One has been with us a number of times before, Dr. Jonathan Shaler, Professor of Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. We've had Professor Shaler on the program on various occasions, and probably most often we have had him on the program to talk about a project for which he is very well known. I maybe should even say renowned, his Shakespeare in Prison project, in which he has taken the wonders of William Shakespeare and some of his greatest plays behind bars and overseen productions of Shakespeare done within prison walls with prisoners as the cast. And it has been an extraordinary experience, not only for him, but needless to say, for the men who have participated in these productions over the years. We have with us also as a very special guest today, Hysan Williams, who is in a sense an alum of the Shakespeare Prison Project, someone who, under the direction of Professor Shaler, acted in Shakespeare plays King Lear, Othello, The Tempest, and Julius Caesar. And now, thankfully, out in the world, a free man, Hysan Williams, is going to be appearing at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside this afternoon at 3 o'clock, presenting a program called The Remarkable Journey of Hysan Williams from Prisoner to Performer on the World Stage, in which he will be talking, I would presume, about really all of his life, including the chapters that he probably now very much regrets, and also the latter chapters that have included encounters with Shakespeare and a measure of inspiring redemption, and it promises to be a very, very special time indeed. And I'm absolutely thrilled that that he can join us today as well in the studios of WGTD to offer a bit about his own story. So, first of all, Professor Jonathan Shaler, we welcome you back, and for the first time, Hysan Williams, we welcome you as well to the morning show.
Pleasure to be here.
Hi, Greg.
good to have both of you here. In a nutshell, Professor Shaler, for the sake of anybody listening today who is not acquainted with your Shakespeare Prison project, just give us a capsule summary of when that began and what sort of prompted such an extraordinary and maybe even audacious idea.
Sure. In 1995, just a year after Pell Grants were cut for prisoners, University of Wisconsin Parkside decided to bring college to Racine Correctional Institution. So a whole bunch of us professors went in there and taught courses on a theme called The Hero's Journey. And I was one of those professors. I taught a course called King, Warrior, Magician, Lover, Archetypes of the Mature Masculine. And that course really clicked with the men. And then from there, I really understood what it meant to offer higher education behind bars, how important that was. So I continued working there on a volunteer basis. And in 2004, I proposed the Shakespeare Prison Project to then-director, education director Jean Teamy, and she helped me get together a proposal. It was accepted. And from 2004 to 2008, we produced the plays that you mentioned that Hysan Williams was in. And then we went on hiatus. I had a son. I took a break, and I came back in 2013, I believe, and we've been going since then, and we've done productions of Hamlet, Midsummer Night's Dream, and we're currently working on The Merchant of Venice.
So your introduction to Hysan Williams, if I understand, was back in the year 2005, so very early on in your
yes.
time with that first spell of Shakespeare in Prison projects. Hysan Williams, before we went on the air, I asked you, is there anything you don't want to talk about? And the short answer was no. You are an open book, and so we are really anxious to know whatever it is you want to share with us about your own story. You were saying that you were born in the great city of Chicago.
Yes, sir.
Tell us a little bit about your early years, the kind of home in which you grew up in, and what your early years were like.
Well, I am the only male child of my mother. I have three sisters, two older, one younger. We were raised in what I would probably be characterized as abject poverty. We did not have much. We relied on food stamps and welfare, which was not different than most people on the South Side, Chicago.
Your dad was not on the scene?
Not, he was in the picture somewhat most of the time, in and out of prison.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier in my life, my father's presence was it brought stress into the household, so it was most times better that he wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
The South Side of Chicago was full of gangs, drugs, and violence, and we were raised in the midst of that. But my mother, to her credit, did everything she could to make sure that we spoke proper English, that we did mm-hmm. not become part of the environment that we were living in, where we could be in it but not of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the things that she did within the household helped all of us, prepare all of us for thinking beyond the poverty of our situation.
Right. If we had known you as a youngster at the, let's say, the age of 10 or the age of 12 or the age of 14, would we have thought of you, I mean, would we have thought of you as a good kid?
Absolutely. I was never in trouble. I was a good student. I had a passion for baseball, specifically Chicago Cubs. And most of my endeavors as a young man were baseball related. In Chicago on Sundays, they have a super transfer. And I would get up early in the morning. I would collect pop bottles and cash them in so that I could have enough for the super transfer. And I would take the L all the way out to the airport, O'Hare, and I would take the luggage carts. I would wait by receiving and get the luggage carts from the businessmen. And they would usually tip me a couple bucks, plus you got the quarter deposit back. And that's the money that I would use to then go to Wrigley to catch a baseball game. Wow. And I would bring the rest of the money home like I'm supposed to because we didn't have a lot of money. But that's the kind of – I had my own business when I was a young man. I always was – no, they would – I would be characterized probably as a good kid.
Right. And did you play baseball also?
I didn't get a chance to play baseball. Interestingly enough, this is an amazing story I like to tell because there's a drug dealer, pimp, legend in Chicago known as Fluky Stokes. And Fluky Stokes is most known for burying his son in a Cadillac coffin, a very ostentatious coffin. Mm. But one thing that a lot of people don't know is Fluky Stokes sponsored youth baseball leagues. And the first chance I ever got to play organized baseball was on a team sponsored by Fluky Stokes. Mm. So I did get to play as a young man, but not a lot.
Wow.
Not until we moved to Iowa.
Where did you move in, move to in Iowa?
We moved to Waterloo, Cedar Falls area.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. Culture shock, to say the least.
And is that sort of the beginning of troubles for you?
No.
No, okay.
No, no. So. As a young person, of course, there was the alcohol and drugs, marijuana, that comes with being a teenager. But I didn't get in trouble until after high school.
Okay, good. And what was life like being in a place like Waterloo, Cedar Falls, compared to Chicago?
Well, it took a while to get used to being able to relax. Because whenever we had a protocol leaving the house in Chicago, there were certain things that you had to do. Make sure that all my sisters were taken care of. Like if we had to walk to school, we would all leave out of the building together, cross the street together, and kind of stay clustered. I always had to walk first whenever we approached an alleyway because anybody could come. I mean, it took a while to get used to being able to just relax. Like the notion that my sister could walk to the store on her own, it was something new, and that takes some adjusting. And then, I mean, it's not to be overstated or understated, but I was living in around white people for the first time in my
right.
life. I had not, other than cops and teachers, my exposure to whites had been minimized, and my parents being Black Panthers was also tainted by, you know, the notion that most white people were racist. Most white people didn't like Black folks, and that I should always consider whites my enemies.
Yeah. What, in fact, did you experience living in Iowa? I mean, were you able to see beyond that?
Absolutely. It was the most enriching experience, and I think I've shared this with Dr. Shaler in the past, is that it opened my eyes to just how human white people were, if I can mm-hmm. state it in that way, that the humanity always will trump ethnicity. And so at the end of the day, while I may have been the first black that my friends had dealt with, we dealt with each other as friends and not as people of different ethnicity. Now, that's not to say that I didn't encounter racism, but I learned at a young age, at a very young age, that racism was somebody else's problem, not mine. Mm.
Well said. For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Haisan Williams, who is an alum of Jonathan Shaler's Shakespeare Prison Project, and he is actually in town for a presentation he's going to be giving at the University of Wisconsin Parkside at 3:00 this afternoon, called "The Remarkable Journey of Haisan Williams from Prisoner to Performer."
Well, I should mention that it's free, and it's also on the main stage at UW Parkside.
Oh, in the ComArts Theater,
right? Oh,
very good. Well, I guess it's time for us to turn the corner here and
okay.
find out how. What occurred to sort of, in a sense, alter the path of your life? Can you give us some sense of?
Sure. I could give you the facts and the details, or I could tell you what led to it. And I choose to tell how I got to where I was.
Sure.
I'm from a home of abuse, and as a young person, abuse, I believe, tends to build up resentment. And when I got old enough, big enough, strong enough to make sure that certain things wouldn't happen to me ever again, I made sure that they wouldn't happen to me ever again. And I overcompensated, and I became the perpetrator rather than the victim. And it changed, my mindset changed past a certain point where I didn't care about anyone else. I decided that if you can't whoop me, you can't stop me. And I learned that because I was tough enough to be successful in most physical confrontations, that power was the way to go. It was the way to have control. And I utilized the control that I had because I had no other control. And I began to prey on the weaker people of society. I began to rob and steal and use force and threat and firearms, and I began to rob. Eventually, it led me to, I robbed a Domino's Pizza and a credit union, and I was arrested in April of 1991. I was
21 years old then?
20.
20, okay.
Subsequently convicted of 2 counts of armed robbery with a few more read in. A read in is a crime where they believe you did it, you acknowledge perhaps that you did it, and it'll allow them to clear the robbery from the books, but you not have the conviction. But the judge is allowed to look at those crimes when he's considering a disposition. I was sentenced to 8 years, of which I served 4 years and 4 months. I was released in August of 1995.
And was this still in Cedar Rapids, Waterloo?
No, this is in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Oh, in Green Bay.
Mm-hmm.
What had taken you to Green Bay?
I should back up. I had college didn't work for me. I was not focused or anything, and I got a job driving a truck, and it was a good job, good money, and I was paying $800 a month rent for a studio apartment about as big as this room in Elmhurst, and I decided, I met a young lady in Green Bay, and my partner that I drove with was more than willing to, I got an apartment, a two-bedroom apartment in Green Bay for $275, so it was a no-brainer, and then I lost a job that I had driving, and I ended up in Green Bay.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And found yourself down this other avenue, taking advantage of these opportunities afforded by your own strength and determination.
Weakness, really. Well, at the end of the day, it reveals itself as weakness. But I chose to I preyed on Green Bay. Being from Chicago, people think that if you've lived there, you know, people think differently. They move differently. They function differently. Small things are the difference between being a victim and not being a victim. And in Wisconsin and in smaller communities, you see people, what we call slipping, you know, where you can take advantage of a perceived weakness.
Right. People are not quite so savvy, not quite so on guard.
Exactly.
And you were right there to take advantage of that.
Yeah.
Can you say a quick word about what this first period of incarceration was like for you? This is years before you're ever going to meet Professor Shaler and be involved in this program. In what was the experience of incarceration like for you? And especially, how did you end up, what kind of a man were you when you left incarceration that first time?
My first experience in prison, the first 2 years were, if I could be frank, it was a party. It was a blast. They had a college program at Green Bay, Green Bay Correctional Institution. This is before they took the Pell Grants. They actually had a full, outside of labs, a full opportunity for college education.
Wow.
And so we took advantage of what we could take advantage of while we were incarcerated. But drugs, alcohol, and I had a blast the first couple years. And I transferred to a different institution. I had a very traumatic experience in my life. There was a young man who had an asthma attack, and I gave him CPR, and he died.
Mm.
And it affected me. And it wasn't too long after that I accepted Islam, and I began to change my life. I started to grow and realized, like, my fullest potential was not being realized by the things that I was doing. It wasn't prison that was holding me back. It was me that was holding me back. And I strove for, you know, excellence. I read all the time. I did what I could insofar as educating myself. I learned how to read and write Arabic. I learned a lot of different things, not knowing specifically what I would need, the tools that I would need to be successful upon release. I learned everything that I could. I began to develop, you mentioned earlier, a certain amount of discipline. And part of that is Islam. The other part is just a will to not be who I was. And also, and I have to say that it is not a small thing to see men who I was serving time with who did not have the opportunities that I was going to have, who were not getting out, at least till we were living like the Jetsons, you know.
Yeah, right.
And so I didn't want to be those guys.
Yeah. And just to be clear, this is still part of that first period of incarceration.
Yes.
So, and if my notes are correct, you were ultimately released in 1995.
That's correct.
It's not too long before you are back in prison.
Reincarcerated 10 and a half months later.
Wow. Can you explain what happened there?
I was, upon my release, I was not prepared. All the things that I mentioned that I read and studied for to try and be prepared for. The one thing I wasn't prepared for was the loneliness that came with having changed my life, removing the drugs and alcohol and partying. So all the so-called friends that I had before I got locked up ceased to exist, and I was lonely. And I found myself getting caught in a cycle of empty relationships with women and empty sexual relationships, just, you know, in and out of bed with women. And it got to the point where my discrimination lessened, and I had inappropriate sexual contact with a minor girl, a 15-year-old girl.
So it was a very different, completely different reason, in a sense.
Oh, absolutely.
For that second incarceration. And by that point, you were a very different person who probably never would have done any of the things that had got you incarcerated in the first place.
I don't think so, but I wouldn't be able to answer that.
Right. So loneliness was what?
It opened the door. Loneliness opened the door, but at the end of the day, my responsibility diminished. I allowed myself to let my responsibility, my social responsibility, my moral responsibility to diminish, because I would rather be with someone than be alone.
Right. Where was this? Was this still
Green Bay,
in Green
as
Bay?
Well, yes.
Wow. So you are incarcerated for nearly 10 years before you meet Professor Shaler. Tell us, first of all, what was it like to be back in prison? And how were you able to come to terms with what had to be just such a brutal reality for you?
Well, that's a interesting question. The reality of knowing I was going back to prison was crushing. The truth of why I was going back to prison was shameful. I had assaulted a 15-year-old girl, and I burned her family's home to the ground. I took someone's home away from them. Their refuge, the place where they should feel most safe, I took from them. And I was ashamed of that. I am ashamed of that to this very day. And that's not me. For me, going to Dodge Correctional Institution, which is the intake institution for the state, and being strip searched and deloused and going through that whole thing again, it was as low as I think I've ever been in my life.
I should think, particularly because at that point you had embarked on this sort of new vision for yourself. You'd be coming.
Not how I saw myself.
Right.
Not at all how I saw myself.
Right.
But nevertheless, it is the reality, and the question was, how did I reconcile myself to being reincarcerated? I let the shame and hurt take me only so far, and then I felt completely driven towards, especially because I went back to prison before I was given my sentence, because I was on parole and they revocated my parole.
Right.
And so I was at Waupun Correctional Institution when they shipped me to Brown County, and I was given my sentence of 25 years. And being shipped back, that reality was the concept of 2.5 decades of justice. I deserved every day of it. And reconciling myself with the reality that this is what you have wrought, these are the consequences of things that you've done, hit me to the point. And keep in mind that my only child was born 3 months after my incarceration began. The first time I ever touched my son was the day I got sentenced. And the weight of all that took me to a level of a decision, really. Do I become the angry convict, or do I do the best I can to be a father to my child? And I struggled through a lot of self-hatred and pushing people away because I wanted to be isolated, and I just had to be a father to my son the best way I knew how. And so I straightened my act up and I struggle discipline because I have an attitude, and at the end of the day, prison's full of scenarios where they are designed for you not to be successful. And while I may negotiate 10 of them successfully, the one may not work out in my favor. And I've told Dr. Shayer this, and I'll tell anyone, part of doing time is being in a hole. If you have, I believe as a man, if you have lines that shouldn't be crossed, and if they are crossed, then you do, and you take the consequences that come with that.
But being in the hole, you mean in segregation?
Segregation, yeah.
Solitary.
Yeah. Mm. 20 people say 23 hours a day. I don't know where they come up with that. It's 24 hours a day. You don't get out an hour a day. Three times a week you get a chance for a rec. Go outside and stand in the cold. But I it's interesting. I was making license plates.
So that really happens in prison.
Oh yeah. And I was I got called out for a visit, and I went on a visit. My son and his mother had come, and I was playing with my son. He was eating his little candy, and he looked at me, and he said, "Dad, when you leave here, will you come and play with me?" Mm. And it crushed me. And I said, "Oh yeah," but I knew that I wasn't gonna be getting out any time where playing would be an option for him or something that he wanted to do, and I went back to work after the visit, and I started throwing dyes, making plates, and I made a decision right then and there that for my son, if for no other reason for my son and for myself, but at the time, it wasn't about at the time. At that time, I think you have to grow to the point where you do things for yourself. At least for me, that was the case. Doing things for my son eventually became about myself. And I outlined my first book, and I began to write it. And I continued to write throughout my incarceration. And the writing, and this is so interesting because we're talking about, Dr. Shane and I talk about narratives and how having a narrative can help you process things, and they've linked having a narrative to the success of men who have been released from prison. I started to write my narrative then and develop my story then for my son, but for myself and my sisters and my mom and my castmates from the Muddy Flower Theater troupe today and in the past. There was a drive to, I knew, and I tell young men this all the time when I was incarcerated, there's nothing wrong believing you're better than this place. I want you to believe you're better than this place because I believed that I was better than that place.
Right.
But until you show that you're better than that place, you are, you know, that is what it is.
Right. So tell us about the moment when you first heard about this crazy thing called Shakespeare Prison Project.
Oh my goodness. I had been in segregation. I was at an institution that had a major incident. While I was not involved in a major incident, I was placed in segregation because the way they let us go to the bathroom was not appropriate by my measure. And so I stood up and I was placed in segregation. They had to find, places to house all the men who had been in, and so they shipped some men to Boscobel, to Stanley. I happen to be fortunate ones because I was shipped to RCI.
To Racine County.
Racine Correctional thing. Racine, I stayed in segregation there until my disposition had been finished. And upon getting out of the intake unit, it was literally the first day I got on a unit, I saw a posting. And I'm paraphrasing what it says. Do you want to be an actor? You ever thought of acting? And I saw the date was September of 2004, so I figured I was too late. What just so happened that one of my brothers in faith, I don't know if I can say his name or not,
first name,
Travail, was in the project, and I had asked about it, and he's like, "Oh yeah, come on down." I'm like, "Are you sure it is not?" Because prison has very strict rules about who can be where at what time, and I wasn't on the list. So we were heading up that night, And I got a visit from my sister. I normally don't get visits because I'm not from Wisconsin. My sister was in town recruiting for her Upward Bound program, and she stopped in. So I visited her, and I came back, and that's when I met Dr. Shaler. They were running lines from King Lear.
Wow.
Yes.
Now, up to that moment, had you had any interest whatsoever in the theater, in being an actor, in Shakespeare?
I did theater in high school. I did stand-up comedy, and I was in comedy sports in Green Bay. I had been involved with theater. And that's why, as soon as when I saw it, I was like, no way. I was blown away. The opportunity to do something like that. When I was in Max, I tried to get them to do, I tried to see if we get like a debate team, something that would help people refine, because people argue all the time in prison. So refine that, make it an art, you know? And anything that would give a person, give myself, I was being selfish, an opportunity to build on skills, to build a skill set that's going to lead to success beyond prison. Prison's not full of those opportunities. They have these cookie cutter programs that, for whatever reason, they believe is the cure-all for everyone.
Right. And it might not speak to who you are or what your particular gifts are or interests.
Exactly.
Right. So what did you think of Professor Shaler the first time you met him? And I'll ask him what he thought of you the first time he met you.
Well, I was late showing up, and I did turn heads when I walked in the room. I'm a bigger dude. I got long dreadlocks, so I don't know what he – I'm interested because I don't think we ever discussed what he thought the first time he saw me, but – I was watching a guy do a scene, and I remember I made a comment, he's rushing his lines. And Dr. Shaler spun around, and I think he either nodded or there was a look of acknowledgement in his eyes. Because the guy was rushing his lines.
And so you knew what you were talking about.
At least there, I did. And from that single night, I introduced myself after they were done doing their scene work, and I asked if I could be involved. I didn't care if I got a part or not. I just wanted to be involved. He opened the door for me. He explained he didn't run down like the rules, like this is what we do here, but he let it be known that this is a process where, you know, everyone has their roles already. And it was, I was welcome with open arms, at least by the director.
Yeah.
So what do you remember about that first encounter?
I remember Hassan was an impressive figure, as I've referred to him since, a force of nature. And very impressive gentleman. He had a lot to offer, it was clear. And he told me that he'd be happy to pick up the role of King Lear if need be. We were so far into the production at that point that I was not about to hand it over to him. So he ended up in a smaller role, but I think it was a good way for us to get acquainted with one another. Because of his tremendous charisma and skill set, I think it was a good way to integrate him into the team as a team player. But it was clear to me that his talent and his leadership made him really appropriate for a lead role in our next production. And that's why I asked him to play the role of Othello in the next production.
Amazing. What an opportunity. I remember the first time Dr. Shaler and I had a conversation about Shakespeare in Prison Project. I still remember inside my head just thinking, what in the world would lead you to think that Shakespeare makes sense to be done in a prison with prisoners who, at least for the most part, had no experience whatsoever with Shakespeare. I mean, why not Tennessee Williams or David Mamet or something that, you know, is in more modern day English and more modern day stories or whatever? And I mean, he had a great answer. And of course, the success, the transformative success of this speaks volumes about the worthiness of the idea. But what's your answer to that question? How does it make sense to do Shakespeare behind prison walls with mostly prisoners who've never done such a thing before in their lives?
Why not? Seriously, what better source, if you're going to have any kind of theater in prison, why not go to the master?
best.
No, seriously, what literature has stood the test of time other than Shakespeare? on the stage, what themes have been more prevalent in human nature than the themes presented in Shakespearean art? It is as contemporarily valid as it was classically valid. When we did King Lear, learning the themes of rejection for Cordelia, those are the gentleman who played Cordelia embodied that role because he felt that way. Mm. It wasn't a gender-specific role. It was a human role. And the humanity in Shakespeare characters transcends time in and of itself. It's as valid today as it was 400 years ago. Mm. So why not? Yeah. Why? And furthermore, if you're going to open a door to something in prison, step outside the box. Don't go for something that challenge the men. Mm. Challenge the men.
Yeah. I guess that's what this comes down to, is not being afraid to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Just talk for a moment about your prison mates, your fellow prisoners. I assume some of whom did not come to this opportunity with the background that you had, mm-hmm. already appreciating who Shakespeare was and so on. Do you think it was for them a similar sort of experience, or was it maybe different for them? I mean, and I'm not suggesting less valuable, but might have been even more valuable maybe for somebody where this was completely new and alien territory. But what can you tell us about some of the other prisoners who would have come to this in very different thing?
While I would say that I benefited most from my participation because of my disposition and my acknowledgement that my spirit is an artistic one, and in order to really feed my spirit properly, I need to be involved in arts, be it writing poetry, playing guitar, or performing. That's just who I am. That's not to say that others didn't benefit equally, if not more. I'm specifically thinking of a gentleman who had issues with regard to communication. He was very socially awkward, more likely than not had some mental issues, because we all know that prisons are now the new mental institutions. Mm. And as a result, he was withdrawn and not as open, but he showed up every week. Twice a week, and he brought it. And at the end of our process, he was an enlightened human being. He felt, first of all, included. And secondly, he participated at a level, his drive in the participation to be, keep in mind, he was dealing with his awkwardness, and he struggled through even through performances, but he did it.
Yeah. And I just want to add, you know, we talk about the Shakespeare Prison Project as if it does something for individuals, and it does, obviously, but the hidden thing is, the really important thing is that it does something for people informing relationships. It's about relationships. So as Haisan talks about this fellow cast member, what he left out was how important Haisan was to this fellow cast member, mm-hmm. in supporting him and building him up and giving him confidence. Very important.
Right. I mean, the same thing that occurs in just about every theatrical experience, where you have that, you build this sense of trust with one another and support and feel a family. And
when people are going to be returned to the streets from prison, I want to see people who are socialized. I want to see people who have good communication skills, good problem-solving skills, and know how to support their fellow human beings. So this is very important.
Mm-hmm. Haisan, were there certain inmates who didn't get this at all? I mean, where this is the last thing in the world they would have wanted to do, and maybe even moreover, maybe went so far as to kind of make fun of you guys who did this? I mean, in the same way that sometimes happens at high school,
sure.
where the quarterback gets razzed because he also wants to sing in the choir or
yeah.
whatever. I mean,
there always is going to be that, because we're dealing with humans and human nature. And it was, I happened, and I say I'm fortunate in that in prison hierarchy, most people didn't mess with me. Many were shocked to find out I was involved in the project, but my participation was broadcast. I didn't try to hide it.
Right.
Initially, I think there was some. I think most of the criticism, reluctance, or angst was staff oriented. It was from staff, because at the end of the day, and I think the proof is in the pudding, in that when we had our performances for the quote unquote inmate population, full house every night, people cared. I had a gentleman come up to me and say, man, I know your name, Haisaba, from this point forward, I know you as Othello. And the if there was criticism, it for me, it rolled off my back, and the guys who would feel it would bring it to the table, to our and I want to speak, if I could, just really quickly on, well, not quickly, but to emphasize that while we were, our objective was to put on a full-length Shakespearean production, the process that we utilized to get to where our performance was viable was the meat and potatoes of it. The performance was secondary. Mm. We put our time in our circle, and if an issue came up, we discussed it, we hammered it out. Dr. Shaler had a methodology where we worked on the language, we worked on artistic performance-related matters, but we worked on humanity issues as well, and we dealt with each other as human beings. If I could just tell a quick story, because Dr. Shaler was his grandmother was not going to be around for much longer, and he came to rehearsal, and he told us that his grandmother, he was about to lose his grandmother, and I think I was the first one to say, why are you here? And what typically we would have our circle for, guys would have issues, we put a circle together for Dr. Shaler. And at the end of the circle, it was, go be with your grandmother.
Mm.
And he did. And that's the strength of our project. The viability of the project is rooted in that we as a cast cared about each other, and we had an objective that was bigger than a performance. We were working towards a performance, but if the performance had to be put on hold so that we could deal with our process, we could work out problems, that's what's going to happen. We've shut down rehearsals to handle issues.
Wow.
And that will remain, I hope it remains that way.
Yeah. So the journey was more important than the destination.
Absolutely. The destination was secondary.
Right. I'm reminded of the Jewish saying, Lafum tzara agra, according to the effort is our reward. I mean,
beautiful.
It is the effort in the journey that means
that
more than everything. So this prison project involves, for you, four different Shakespearean projects, and then this goes on hiatus. We don't have much time, but can you just say a word about life in prison after this chapter closed with the Shakespeare Prison Project, and where did you find the strength, in a sense, to go on from there with this, without this really valuable opportunity in place anymore?
Well, if I could be frank, I existed in prison before Shakespeare, and I existed in prison after Shakespeare. So, the Shakespeare Prison Project didn't define me, but what it did do is, while I was the guy who walked with my head held high, I had walked with my head held high knowing that it wasn't bravado. I've shown that I can do positive things even in the most negative situation. And I know for a fact that I developed leadership skills that I did not have prior to participating in the Sacred Prison Project. And I recognize how important leadership is.
Mm.
And so I became a better leader. Mm. 5 years that I was incarcerated after the project were, I participated in my offense-related treatment. I moved forward. I continued to write. I have a co-defendant who turned state's evidence on me. He took the stand against me, and my spirit allowed me to just forgive that, to leave it, because I didn't want to hold on to anything that was going to weigh me down upon getting out. I grew as a human being. And I can't say that I would have had to grow without the Shakespeare Prison Project, but because I did have the Shakespeare Prison Project. And I have to say this also, because I was sharing with Tammy, my girlfriend, how understanding someone's dramatic need has helped me deal with people as a human, inside and outside. And while my dealings with staff in prison were for the most part positive, I did have issues, and the way I process is trying to understand what's motivating that person. If I learn nothing else, it's understanding one's dramatic need. And that's helped me deal with people better.
Hmm. So what has life outside prison walls been like for you since getting out in 2013?
It's been a struggle. No, it has been difficult to find meaningful full-time employment. I was recently released from a job that I was hired for, believing that they would train me. They never trained me. And I was released. I do have full-time, not full-time, but I have gainful employment in that. I'm a server at one of the best restaurants in Green Bay. So I can pay my bills. I was looking to purchase property, but that's obviously going to have to wait until I can get another job. But it's the struggle is, I don't mind the struggle. That's part of my life.
Right.
I have a beautiful dog that I just, Brutus, his name is Brutus, of course. That's the last role I played.
Ah.
And I have two cats, Cassius and Ariel.
Oh, man.
I have a lovely, lovely girlfriend who is an amazing person. My relationships with my son, my mom, my sisters, while strained at times, they are strong and solid. My ability to be a friend is significantly better. I don't want anything from anyone. Whereas before, my friendships were based on convenience and ability to get something from.
Right.
I'm having genuine, authentic relationships. And I'm experiencing the world with appreciation for the small things. Even getting fired from a job at the end of the day didn't crush me. And that's part of a real life situation. That's part of being an adult in the world and struggling through adversity. And I wrote a poem one time, and I ended it and said, on the other side of adversity, that's where you'll find me. And that's where I am.
Tell us briefly what you're going to be doing this afternoon at 3 o'clock in this presentation called The Remarkable Journey of Haisan Williams from Prisoner to Performer. What are you going to be doing?
Well, we are going to do a bit of a Othello, but I'm going to flip the script. I am actually going to be reading as Iago.
Ah, the bad guy.
Yes, or the good guy. And I want to just say that the fellow who played Iago in our prison performance was amazing. I don't know if I can't say his name,
first
but
name.
David was amazing. He was purely Machiavellian. I think that's what Gene Ferraca characterized. He really, if my performance was heralded, it was because I fed off such a great performer.
That makes all the difference.
It does. I will be sharing my life story, kind of, and this is the coolest thing about this, is that this is the first time that I've done a presentation. I've probably done 5 or 6 of these where I have more post-incarceration to share. So I will be sharing my life up until prison, my life during prison, and my life after prison. Three segments that I will share. I will also be performing from Othello, but I like to be able to give some insight as to how I ended up in prison, what I did while I was in prison. And I can say without a doubt, and this is 100% true, that the successes that I'm having in the quote-unquote real world are rooted in the way I did my time and the opportunities that I had while I'm doing my time.
Wow, that's such an important story that could really be a immense value to so many people. Professor Shaler, I can't imagine what's in your heart right now as you are. Of course, you already knew so much of this story, but tell us what's in your heart in the moment.
Well, my heart is very full because sitting here beside me is a remarkable human being with so much talent, so much love, so much grace as a human being, and to see him have the opportunities to flourish as he is now on the other side of a really, really hard life, to put it mildly, is tremendously gratifying. So I'm honored to be here in his presence.
Haisan Williams, it's been my honor as well to meet you and to hear something of your story, and appreciate you being so open and so honest and so articulate, so eloquent in sharing the story of your life, the bright chapters and the chapters very dark, and your emergence from those dark chapters to a life that we hope will be increasingly full and rich, and that you will continue to make a difference for the better in the world. And I appreciate you joining me today on the morning show, and we hope a lot of people will turn out this afternoon at 3 o'clock for your free presentation at Parkside in the ComArts Theater called The Remarkable Journey of Haisan Williams. It is remarkable indeed, and thank you for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Good to have you here. On Monday's program, I'll be speaking with the author of a wonderful new book called Lab Girl, in which she talks about her lifelong love of science and her work as a scientist in the lab. Also, we will reacquaint you with Steve Koss and his